And hello and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing, as usual, features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today we have Elizabeth Berg with us for the entire hour. But before I introduce her, I want to remind all of you that today and for the next week is our annual fund drive. We only do this once a year to keep KUCI on the air. KUCI is run by volunteers. I'm a volunteer. My co-host Marie Stone is a volunteer. We have 100 volunteers here at Orange County's only eclectic alternative radio station. And we need you to help us out by giving a call to 949-UCI-KUCI, and that is 949-824-5824. Call now to make a pledge. We have incentives, books, CDs, various things, and your donation is tax deductible. It's something like if you make a $35 basic pledge, that comes out to $2.92 a month or 67 cents a week. For 67 cents a week, you can listen to Writers on Writing. Of course, you can listen anyway, but you have access to podcasts 24/7. You know, so much is going on here other than my show, although just with this show alone, just a basic pledge would just be delightful and wonderful and help us incredibly. Again, the number's 949-UCI-KUCI. If you give a call, you can talk to Marie Stone and also make suggestions for authors you'd like to have on the show. In any case, my guest today is Elizabeth Berg. She's the author of many novels, including the New York Times bestsellers Dream When You're Feeling Blue, We Are All Welcome Here, The Year of Pleasures, The Art of Mending, Say When, True to Form, Never Change, and Open House, which was an Oprah's Book Club selection in 2000. Durable Goods and Joy School were selected as American Library Association Best Books of the Year, and Talk Before Sleep was shortlisted for the Abbey Award in 1996. The winner of the 1997 New England Booksellers Award for her work, she's the author of the nonfiction book Escaping into the Open, The Art of Writing True. She's also a playwright and adapted her novel The Pull of the Moon for the stage. We're here to talk about her current book and so much else, which is The Day I Ate Whatever I Wanted, a book of short stories published by Random House. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
Great to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start by talking about your most current book, The Day I Ate Whatever I Wanted. How did this book of stories come about?
Came about because I was ordering lunch with some girlfriends, and what do you think we ordered? Salad. That's the only thing women ever order. And I said, one of these days, I'm going to write a story called The Day I Ate Whatever I Wanted. And here we have it.
Here we have it. Is that how your books typically come about? I mean, is it just sort of, you know, an off-the-cuff kind of thing that happens, and you go, you know what, this is a book? Or all sorts of ways, I imagine.
No, they're all different. They certainly don't come about in this kind of flip way usually. And I meant this book, when I thought of it, to be a collection of humorous stories, and a lot of them are. But there's a lot of serious material in here, too, and that surprised me, as I have seen that it's surprised a lot of readers, too. There's one story in here that's frankly sad, you'll probably need your hanky for. There's a mix of humor and pathos in most of them, and some of them are a lot lighter. But it was really fun writing this book.
You are so great at telling details, of just giving a few details that describe a character. For instance, in the story Truth or Dare, one character, Joyce, has a voice that you describe being like Georgette on the old Mary Tyler Moore Show. And that is a perfect way of describing voice for readers to just really understand who, at least partly, who this character is. Talk about that, the telling details of your characters. And you know, I mean, how did you figure that Joyce had that voice, or, you know, any number of telling details? Do you, well, just talk about that, because you're just expert at it.
Well, thanks for saying that, but I think that, just as a general observation, for me, that's what separates a writer from a non-writer, is that writers have an eye for detail, for the interesting detail, and for the detail that lets you know who the person is. And I think it's just something that goes along with being a writer, and you will use it also just in conversation. If you're telling about someone you met and you're describing them, it will be that telling detail that you focus on.
Well, what about that story, Truth or Dare? There's a group of women meeting for lunch, and they all decide that they're going to get in touch with someone, an old boyfriend from years before. How did this story come about?
You know, I don't know is the answer. so much about writing for me is a mystery, and I actually really like and respect that. I think it was E.B. White who said he didn't like to look under the hood too much, and that's how I feel too. I can tell you that it's always been an alluring prospect for me to think about calling an old boyfriend, especially after it's been so many years. I'm 59 now, so there's a big difference between going to a high school reunion 5 years after you've graduated and calling an old boyfriend when it's been 40 years since you've seen them. But it's just an intriguing idea for me. So I was interested in these women anyway, and they just kind of decided to do that. And I think I knew early on, too, that the main character would be interested in doing something a little more subversive.
It's interesting, though, what you say about, you know, E.B. White saying, you know, not liking to look under the hood, and what you're talking about, analyzing. It does seem that sometimes when writers do spend too much time wondering why, either why they're writing or why their attraction to writing or whether they should be a writer or about how to come up with ideas or execute ideas, that it seems that those are the times that writers get stuck.
Yeah. There's a Paul Simon song where he says, "You want to be a writer? Find a quiet place and a humble pen." And I really like that idea. Yeah, it can be a real problem when you get all wrapped up in worries about writing, when you're more focused on the end product than the act of simply doing it, which can be sublime. And it becomes a problem, too, when you've been published a lot and you would be naive to think that what you're working on probably isn't going to be passed on to your editor and then published. And if you let yourself fall into that trap, you really can get paralyzed. It becomes more difficult as you go on publishing books, I think, to get all the people out of the room and to have that simple relationship between you and the page, a kind of innocent relationship and primal in a way, and not think about anything but transferring what's in your head and your heart onto the page, and to really keep it a separate business, the publishing business, like church and state. It's one thing to do the writing, and it's another thing altogether to look at the business aspects of it, agents and editors and sales and reviews and book tours and all that stuff, just utterly separate.
How did you find your way to writing? How did you become a writer?
I was always a writer. When I was a little kid, I really loved writing. I didn't try to get published until my mid-30s. And I tried at that point because I was working as a nurse part-time, and I didn't like leaving my children with babysitters. And I'd always gotten a lot of encouragement from friends and teachers who said, "Oh, you should be a writer." And so I thought, well, maybe I'll be a writer. I knew nothing about it. I was completely naive, and actually that probably helped me, because otherwise I would have been terrified. So I just went down to the drugstore and bought a bunch of magazines and started submitting personal essays. That's how I got started. And I did that for 10 years, wrote for magazines. Then at the point at which I knew I wanted to try writing a novel, I got an agent, and then I switched to the longer form, and the rest is history.
Hmm. Interesting. You're listening to KUCI FM 88.9, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We are in the midst of a fund drive and need your help. Please call 949-UCI-KUCI and talk with my co-host Marie Stone, make a pledge, receive a premium, and help us keep the lights on and keep the phones working. And today I'm with Elizabeth Berg. Her current book is The Day I Ate Whatever I Wanted and Other Small Acts of Liberation. In talking about how you got started, which is different than how a lot of people these days think of getting started, which is namely going to MFA programs. And without MFA programs, you know, will they be able to get published? Will they be able to, you know, call themselves a writer? What do you think about all that?
I think that good writing wins out. I think if you write well and you have a good story to tell and you send it out there, you have a very good chance of being published. I think you have to know yourself as a person and as a writer before you decide to go to an MFA program. And there are some really good ones. UC Irvine is one of them. But some people are cut out to withstand the kind of criticism that goes on in those programs, and I've only heard about it. I've not experienced it, of course. And other people are not. And I worry about people who feel devastated by criticism and shut down as a result of it.
Or who, right to the workshop mentality, right to what perhaps they feel is expected of them.
Or just, what I like best as a reader is to find an original voice, someone who's not trying to copy someone else or write in any given style, but is utterly original. And that's getting harder to find. There's a lot of imitative writing going on, a lot of overdone writing in many ways. I point to Alice Munro as a writer I admire very, very much, who does not do that, who really is, she lets the writing, she gets out of the way of the writing, I guess is the best way to say it. So I think you can improve, and I think you can hone your techniques, and I think writing programs might be a good place for you to do that. I also think that publishers who see that a writer comes out of UC Irvine or Iowa, you know, takes a look at that. It doesn't go unnoticed. But in the end, it has to be the writing.
Sure. Well, and you said know yourself as a writer. Could you embellish on that? Are you talking about kind of know what you want to write, know the sorts of stories you're attracted to? What are you talking about there?
I guess it comes to honoring your voice as a writer, to, again, not be imitative. If you're a writer, there's a style that comes naturally to you that feels best to use, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel odd talking about this, because what I really, really believe is what I said earlier, that it's all a great mystery.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I've been able to see, I've taught in a couple of places. I'm not a very good teacher, but I have seen that, in my opinion, the people who write the best are the people who just let it happen.
And voice. Talk about coming into your voice, and also, do you feel that once you have a voice, that it stays the same through the various work that you do, or does it change from project to project, or should it?
It changes somewhat. It depends. I can point to this collection of stories, for example. The story called Rain is in a very, very different style than, say, The Day I Ate Whatever I Wanted. And it's because of what the story is. But ultimately, I feel like voice is kind of your personality changed into writing. And for me, my voice has always been like someone talking to someone else. It's very informal. It's intimate. And it's pretty unembellished.
So, are you ever picturing an audience? Are you ever writing for one person or for a group of people, or an idea comes to you for a story or even a novel, and you think this is for so and so? I have to write this for so and so.
No. I write for myself. For me, it's death to think that I'm writing for a group of people, because then you get into the how do I please them problem.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to limit that to yourself first and foremost. That's where you have to start. You please yourself. When you're done, then think about if you're going to try to publish it, whether or not it will please the place you're sending it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Will you read to us?
Sure.
And if you...
I've been talking so much, I'm losing my voice. But I'll read you a little from the sister story, The Day I Ate Whatever I Wanted, which is called The Day I Ate Nothing I Even Remotely Wanted.
Okay.
Those Weight Watcher meetings are murder. There's always a bunch of brown nosers who get little presents and applause for the pounds they lost. Sometimes a little whoop, too. There's this woman at my meetings who whoops for people. And the leader always makes this announcement at the end of the meeting about how many pounds were lost this week by a whole group. I sit in the back, staring at my lap, because week after week I mostly lose nothing. Well, one time I lost 3 pounds. I'd had the flu. And the whole time I was embracing the toilet, a part of me was saying, yes. Next meeting, 2.5 pounds had come right back on, saying, hey there, Bubbles, did you miss me? Still, the meetings do work for getting me motivated over and over again. They make me feel like when I was a little girl and went to confession every week. All the way home, I used to walk so slow and tight to keep my soul spotless. But as soon as I came in the door, there was my brother. Same thing with the meetings. Each time I vow it's going to be different this week. And then, on the way home, I see a Krispy Kreme, no line, or, you know, my kitchen. It's okay, my leader always tells me. We all slip up once in a while. You come to the meetings every week. That's a great start. Just try to eat less now. Her eyes are kind. Her belt is cinched a bit too tight. But hey, let her take credit where credit is due. One thing about those leaders, I always wonder about their personal lives. I mean, are they always like this? If so, do their coworkers at their real jobs want to slug them? Sometimes I wonder so hard about their personal lives it keeps me from paying attention to the meeting, which always has a little allegory of some kind, some story you're listening to, wondering what does that have to do with anything, and then whomp. A diet lesson has been delivered. I feel kind of sorry for my leader. She tries so hard. So yesterday, just for her, I tried to eat right. I began breakfast with coffee and skim milk. Do you know what drinking coffee with skim milk is like? It's like asking for a dress and being handed a slip. Also, I had toast, which was equally disgusting because it was toast made the new way, using diet bread, a.k.a. cardboard. Here is my recipe for toast made the old way. 1. Go to the bakery and buy a loaf of freshly baked white bread. 2. Take 2 slices from the middle of the loaf and toast them to just light brown. 3. Lay the toast out on a beautifully patterned antique china plate that has a rim of gold and must be washed by hand, but it's worth it. 4. Saturate the toast with a rounded tablespoon of pluquera butter, European-style, higher fat content, which has been melted in an old cast-iron skillet that your grandma gave you that never was and is not now all that clean. Just to be clear, that would be a rounded tablespoon of butter on each piece of toast, all the way to the corners and then some. 5, cut the toast on the diagonal into 4 lovely pieces. 6, dunk in hot chocolate you've made with Dutch processed cocoa and cream and over which you've sprinkled 50 or 60 little mini marshmallows, very fresh and boingy ones. 7, eat while dialing the number for the Buddha. When he answers, say, "You want contentment? I'll show you contentment."
Thank you so much.
Sure.
That was Elizabeth Berg reading from her new collection of stories, The Day I Ate Whatever I Wanted, published by Random House. And that story was, "The Day I Ate Nothing I Even Remotely Wanted." So much to talk about still. Fortunately, we have another half hour. I wanted to ask you about how much, in writing short stories, and in the second half I'd like to talk a little bit more about novels, but how much you know, well, I know, I'm kind of talking over myself. I know you don't seem to want to know too terribly much about the process, but in terms of the stories themselves, how much do you know when you begin? Are you going for something? Do you know how you want it to turn out? Or do you want to be surprised in how the characters behave and what they end up doing?
Much more the latter. I find that if I try to outline, it never works because the story wants to go in its own direction. I believe in letting the material tell me rather than the other way around. That said, I think it's very important to acknowledge the fact that writers are all different, and you have to find what works best for you and then honor your own way of writing. Some really great writers, Sue Miller and Ann Patchett, know the story before they begin writing it. But I like to just fall into a sort of trance and just let something come that I didn't know was coming.
And with stories, will you try to get a first draft in one sitting, or do you just take as long as it needs to take, as long as the story requires?
Right, more the latter. I usually write in the morning, as close to getting up as possible, because I think that I'm linked more to the dream world then, and I like that place. And I'll write for 3 or 4 hours, sometimes 5, pretty intensely. Sometimes with short stories, I can get a draft of a whole story done if it's a short one. More often, though, it's part of a story that begins taking off, and then I keep working on it until it's done, and that takes varying lengths of time.
Interesting. Okay. Well, we're going to take a real short break, and when we return, we'll have more Elizabeth Berg, so stay with us. And remember, we do have a fun drive going on. Marie Stone is by the phones. 949-UCI-KUCI. We need your help, so please give a call, and be back in a few minutes.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. We gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, woman built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
This is Will Bruzzo.
And this is Sean Fagot.
And we're from The Aggressive Moderate.
The political show where we don't agree on anything.
But we agree on one thing.
Supporting KUCI through your generous contributions.
From April 26th to May 10th, you will have the opportunity to contribute to KUCI by calling 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI, or going to KUCI.org and following the prompts to contribute.
Donate today.
And listen to The Aggressive Moderate every Thursday at 5 p.m.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Listen to Writers on Writing every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We're also on iTunes. If you go to Public Radio and down to KUCI, you can tune in right away. And you can listen live at KUCI.org. We're here with Elizabeth Berg. And before I bring her back on, I need to tell you we're in a fun drive for the next few days. I think next week during my show, it'll still be going on as well. Would love for you to call 949-824-5824. Make Marie very happy to take your call and take your pledge. A very minimum basic pledge of $35 will get you a premium. It's something like 67 cents a week to listen to the show. And you'll help with the phone bills for we call our guests, and most of the shows here that we do on Writers on Writing are with guests who are afar, anywhere around the country. So your pledge will go to keeping that going on so that we can continue to call and have guests from the far reaches of the U.S. come on the air with us. Again, it's 949-UCI-KUCI. Call if you would and help us out and I want to bring Elizabeth Berg back on. Hi there.
Hey.
There she is. She is author of many books and so many wonderful, wonderful works, including her most current, The Day I Ate Whatever I Wanted, and other small acts of liberation published by Random House. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about novels. I recently read The Year of Pleasures that you published. I don't even have the year anymore, but I loved that book. And as I was reading it, I thought your main character was so non-generic. She had a little, you know, crazy notion of after her husband died, she was just going to sort of get in the car, pick a place, drive to the Midwest, and plant herself, buy a house, and start over. And that seemed like such a great character detail, as so many of your characters have details, these wonderful details and sort of non-generic approaches to life. Are you thinking that when you're sitting down, when you started writing that novel, did you think, how can I make this character different? Or, once again, is this just this organic thing that happens when you start writing where you're just going to see?
Yeah, it's more organic. That is a fantasy I've had. Every time I like to drive on the back roads when I drive across country, and every time I go through small towns, I think, what would it be like to just cut bait and move somewhere and start all over? Of course, in the Year of Pleasures, that's something that she intended to do with her husband, and then he died, and before he died, he asked her to do it without him, and that's indeed what she does.
Hmm. Actually, and I listened to that book on CD, and wondered what you think of your books on CD. Do you listen to them? Do you like books on CD, or do you feel like it sort of hampers with the voice that you intended?
I do like books on tape. One in particular that I really, really love is Alice Munro's Open Secrets. I think that's just a brilliant production. When it comes to my own work, I don't like to listen to my own books on tape, and I have had the experience of being really frustrated at the way someone read my work because they put the emphasis in the wrong place, or they try to sound like a man, which really drives me crazy when they, doesn't it?
I mean,
yes, he said, oh, come over. Okay, he said. I just hate that.
So a while ago, I asked if I could read my own books, and starting with We Are All Welcome Here, I do now read my own work.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I wondered about that, because as I was listening to The Year of Pleasures, I was wondering how the experience of reading the book would have differed if I was actually reading it, you know, on the page as opposed to listening, which I quite enjoyed. But yeah, when the narrator, you know, picked up, or the actress read the guy, I thought, is that how the guy would sound? You know, would he sound like that?
Yeah. I mean, come on. We know you're not a guy. You can just read the line. We can imagine how the guy would say it.
Oh, well, I'll have to check out some of your books that you've read, because I love it when an author's actually reading and doing well. You know, there's one author I think I listened to that I said, oh, no, she shouldn't be reading her own book. But anyway, most of the time it's pretty great. You are so prolific, and you say you started writing essays in your 30s, and 10 years later started writing novels. And you have so many books out. How do you remain so prolific? How are you doing this? Because your work is all such high quality. And how's this happening?
You know, writing is what I like to do most in my life. It's the place I want to be. It's my therapy and my solace and my entertainment. And I don't feel well if I don't write. So it's been my habit to finish one thing and then move right into the next. I'm very interested in writing. Recently, I had a cervical disc injury, and I was not able to write, and it was just awful. I mean, this went on for months. So I'm actually behind. There won't be a book out next spring for the first time in a long time.
Mm.
But I don't write to keep up that pace. I don't write saying, oh, I have to hurry up and get this done because I have a book due. My publisher doesn't put any pressure on me that way, nor do I put it on myself. It's just that I like to write,
mm-hmm.
and I write very quickly. I always have, and I hope to keep this up for as long as I'm able.
Mm. So then, I mean, do you, you know, you just said you write quickly. Do you get a draft down and then spend a long time revising, or are you able to just, give yourself a period of time and say, okay, it's done. It's just done now. It's time to send it off, and not belabor the process too much?
Yeah. What I do is I write new pages, let's say Monday through Friday every morning, when I come in the next day, I edit those pages I wrote the day before, and then I move on. When I've finished the book, and that I know there's just some sort of internal put her into park that happens. I mean, just clunk, done. I just know I'm done. Then I go back and read the whole manuscript and edit it. So it's been edited all along the way, but then I do it again, and then I send it in.
Hmm. How do you know, in writing novels, how do you know when an idea you have or maybe just, you know, a glimmer of something that you have is hefty enough to sustain a novel-length manuscript? You know, I mean, writers have no lack of ideas, so getting the ideas tends to not be the problem. It's how do you know when one is going to stick?
Well, again, I think this goes back to the writing. It's all in the writing. I think of Francis Itani's Remembering the Bones, which was a novel I admired very much. All that happens, in quotes, happens, is that a woman has a car accident, is flung from her vehicle, and is lying in a ditch remembering things. That's all that happens. But it is a rich and beautiful novel because of the writing. So I think that it's the depth that you go to. The plot doesn't matter so much. For me, I don't read thrillers or mysteries. I think there are probably a lot of good ones out there, but I don't read them. I'm not interested in that. And there can be a lot of action happening in a story or in a novel, but it can be curiously lightweight for me. I like to have a certain kind of emotional plumbing, I guess, and authenticity of character, a validation of what it means to be human somehow. So that's what I look for, and I think that for me, the difference between short stories and novels is that a short story is more a moment explored fully, a kind of 360-degree look at a moment that is an epiphany or a turning point or something so extraordinary that you realize either then or in retrospect. Once someone described a short story as something like what you would tell someone in a car. You know, you're riding along together and you're eating your ice cream and you say, hey, you know what? One time I was in this ice cream store and there's your story. Whereas a novel, you meander along the road and tell lots of stories to serve the purpose of one overarching theme.
That's a great way of describing it, especially describing what a short story is. Yeah, I like that. But, you know, I can't help but think of when you say this novel you described of the woman being thrown from the car and, and remembering, I can't help but wonder how, okay, so many agents want you to, you know, write them, you know, in your query letter, write about your novel, what happens, what's going on. And I can't help but think so many agents would say, but nothing happens. What happens here?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why you don't submit a query letter with a novel for a first novel. You submit the novel.
Mm.
Because it's so difficult to talk about what happens in a novel. I remember when my first novel was accepted, my agent sent it to two publishers, both of whom wanted to buy it. So I came to New York to meet with editors from each house. The editor from one house said, can you tell me what's going to happen? Because I had submitted a partial manuscript. And I said, I started to talk about it, and I said, you know, I can't. I don't know. I mean, it has to go where it leads me. And she said, well, you know, I kind of need to know in order to come up with the right offer. I need to tell my higher-ups how this is going to end. And I said, well, I just sort of can't. And the second editor, who's my editor today, Kate Medina at Random House, said, can you tell me what's going to happen? Same thing. I started to, and I said, no, I just have a really hard time. She said, that's fine.
Mm.
Tell me a word. That's the one I'm with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Kate knows a lot about writers and writing.
Mm. Yeah, because the marketplace is just, you know, it's in these days especially, I think it's in the back of so many writers' heads. It's sitting on their shoulder when they're writing. It's in the office. It's in the room because, you know, we just, writers hear such dire predictions of, you know, the future of novels and and that if they want to get published, they had better go the nonfiction route. And
Yeah. Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. Listen, it's true. People are reading less than they were. We're all so screen oriented, and nobody has time. Nobody has time. Still, those books come along that remind people of the glory of reading, and I think that's what we should remember. It's so important, and I know how hard it is, but it's so important to keep those voices out of your writing space. Just, you know, separate it. Tell yourself, okay, I'll let myself think about that later, but right now I just have to serve the story that I'm writing. And you know what? They don't know what they want in New York publishers. They don't know what they want. But when they see something good and it's finished, then they'll want to take it. Look at The Lovely Bones. Who would have thought a story about a young girl who was raped and died would be the success that it was?
Sure.
Look at Harry Potter. It was rejected how many times? 17? I don't know. You can't think about that when you're trying to do good work, or you'll drive yourself crazy.
Yeah. And then stories like Confederacy of Dunces, who he did go crazy, and I believe committed.
His mom had to shop it.
Yeah, after he died. It's like, okay, and then it became a raging success.
I think you also have to get straight with yourself about who you are and what you're intending to do. If you look at the bestseller list right now, you have things on there like Jhumpa Lahiri's magnificent collection of stories. You also have crap on there, and there's always crap on there. Still, everybody's dying to get on the New York Times bestseller list, and I'm one of them, dying to get on there. Why? In the end, what matters most to me is that you've been true to yourself and done the best work that you can, that you haven't sold yourself short. And then, in the world of the business, what matters is how many copies you sell, not whether or not you get on the bestseller list. Because you can sell, you know, people can get on the bestseller list and you can outsell them because you continue to sell in good numbers after they have their flash in the pan New York Times bestseller moment, and then sales taper off. So there's a lot more than meets the eye that goes on in the business of book selling. But I can tell you, as a New York Times bestseller, I was on Oprah, I've had a lot of success. Nothing compares to the feeling of getting what's inside you out onto the page. That is the big satisfying thing about writing, not getting on the New York Times bestseller list or making lots of money or any of that. It helps. It helps buy the groceries. God knows we all need more money in times like these, but that's not what satisfies your soul.
Yeah, I mean, it is the writing. It's so often, my students anyway, just, you know, will say, am I a writer? Do I have what it takes? You know, it's like, well, I don't know. I mean, is there anything you want to do more? And if not, yeah, you do have what it takes.
Right.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you real briefly about, about beginnings and endings, because, you know, in writing, and especially in reading your short stories where you have lots of beginnings and endings, it seems that the last one of the books, Sin City, it ends just or it begins just wonderfully. You know, for years now, Rita has been living half a banana life. What a great way of introducing a character, and it ends wonderfully as well. What sort of thought do you give to beginnings and endings, and are you trying to kind of draw the ending around to in some sort of circular way to the beginning?
Well, you know, first of all, thanks for mentioning that story. That's one of my favorites in this collection. I really loved how that story came about, and the germ for that story, the impetus for that story was I found a charm bracelet in an antique store that was loaded with charms, and I I felt like I was wearing another woman's life on my wrist when I wore that. And I remember talking to Louise Erdrich about it. I was wearing it when I had tea with her one day, and I said, you know, I really want to write a story featuring this bracelet. And she said, ooh, yeah, you wear the bracelet and you become the other woman. And in some respects, that's what I was thinking of doing, and as it happened, the story went a different way. But when I write a story at the beginning, I just sort of plunge in the middle. I'm not big on setting things up, I guess. I start as though we already know everybody. It's an unconscious thing, though. And at the end, this again is that feeling of just somehow knowing that you have said what you wanted to say, and now you do a very kind of light pulling back and away from that story. I like a kind of gentle ending. I like an ending that makes the rest of the story suddenly resonate in another way. Other writers are far more successful than I at doing that kind of thing. Jim Lahiri, Toby Wolf, you know, Alice Munro, where you just suddenly see the whole story again in a new light. But I like my endings to be, for the most part, really very gentle.
Well, we are at the end of our time, and I wonder if you have any last words to offer the writers who are listening.
I think that to try to experience the joy that I know is in anybody who's really a writer, you have so much joy when you do it, and to try to focus on that more than the anguish, because there's too much anguish in the world already, to understand that when you are starting something, when you're doing a draft, that nobody has to see it but you. So take some chances and surprise yourself, and you may end up liking that better than anything you've planned. Also to remember that the world is vast, and to be a writer is a noble thing, but not the only thing. So don't slit your wrists over a rejection, you know. Go out and see what the world has to offer and be enriched by it. You're a writer for a reason. You have a way of seeing and appreciating and translating the world that will be there always.
Thanks so
much. Amen.
You're quite inspiring, and I appreciate you taking the time and being with us.
I'm very glad to have talked with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Send in your money. Send in even $5. Everything counts. Just like Barack Obama tells you, send in $25 and suddenly he's got this huge chest. Tell your listeners to send in. If they can't send in $35, send $5.
$5 would be great. $5 would be perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was Elizabeth Berg. Her latest book is The Day I Ate Whatever I Wanted, and she also has a website. I'm not sure I have. Oh, it's elizabeth-berg.net, and you can find out lots more by going to her website. And it's true. We have this fund drive, and we need $5. We need a dollar. Call and pledge 949-UCI-KUCI. That's 949-824-5824. We only do this once a year. We're not like some other public radio stations that, you know, every other month. No, it's not that often, but, you know, you turn it on, there they are again. We do this once a year at this time of year, and really just need your support very much. And Marie and I would so appreciate you calling in right now. Go to the phone. The show is over. Please help us out. You'll get a premium. It's tax deductible. And we will forever be indebted to you for doing that. I'm going to leave you now. And just to let you know, if you want to know more about the show, go to penonfire.com. You can email me from there. And you can find out more about the podcast by clicking on the radio tower on the left side of the page, the home page of the website. I'm going to leave you with a quote by John Steinbeck, who said, We work in our own darkness a great deal with little real knowledge of what we are doing. Thank you so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book is Pen on Fire. I'll see you next week.
KUCI's Fun Drive is happening from April 26th through May 10th.
Yeah!
We really could use your support this year. Help us out this year with a tax-deductible donation during our Fun Drive.
Yeah!
You can donate by calling 949-824-5824